So I guess this is our second time here. Had a little bit of a problem technically. Thanks for fixing it, Amber. Hopefully it's fixed anyway. I was asked by Curatorial Industries to participate in their self-storage project. I thought that to begin this recording, I'd read the memorandum they sent on January 21st, inviting me to participate. Curatorial Industries invites you to contribute to the temporary special collection self-storage. This collection will be assembled in a storage unit located at 300 Treat Avenue in San Francisco. The collection will be comprised of standardized boxes with contributions by artists and archivists. From April 18th until May 18th, 2008, the collection will be open to the public under the care of a librarian and indexed for consultation and handling by the public. Self-storage is inspired by the historical precedent of Buckminster Fuller's De Maxim Chronophile. Beginning in 1915, Fuller systematically recorded his life in 15-minute intervals. The chronophile gathers ephemera, such as ephemera, photographs, sketches, receipts, and predictions. Using his own life as an exhaustive case study, he assembled these loose connections as distinct volumes, which were bound together or sorted in boxes. Curatorial Industries proposes to create a parallel self-recording structure for the use of both artists and archivists alike. The standard architecture that we have selected is the cardboard box, banker's box, really.
It's 11 o'clock.
The box has been selected as the organizing principle of the exhibition in order to investigate several interests. The opening closing function of the box, the storage function of the box, both preserving and obliterating, and the legacy of the box in artist multiples and additions. Enclosed, you will find a box. We invite you to use this box in whatever way you wish. It is an exhibition space that will become part of a larger exhibition. An international selection of 30 artists and archivists working in different media and engaged in various collecting practices has been invited to participate. We ask that your box be ready to ship by March 1st, 2008, so that we may begin cataloging and indexing its contents in preparation for public viewing. You may also select the next destination for your box after its time under our care. We look forward to your reply.
Okay, so do you have any idea about why Curatorial Industries has invited you to be one of these 30 artist archivists to be part of this?
I guess. I was asked to be part of their group of advisors for this show, and part of, I took that to mean that I would give them a tour of my collection here at the in the basements, and because they were going along in the direction of making some kind of publication, and specifically one that might be contained in a box, I gave them an overview of publications that are in boxes here, I guess they found that there was enough here to possibly invite me to do something with. I guess also I can respond reasonably well, I suppose, by material anyway, of dealing with the legacy of the box in artist multiples and additions. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. The what I'm going to do here today, hopefully, assuming the recording works, is to chronologically overview a selection of publications that are contained in boxes from my collection. The first...
What years are we talking about? What sort of... our historical range are you going to be covering today with these box editions?
As I don't have a bottom valise, we're not starting that early. I'm starting around 1965 with the publication Aspen Magazine, the magazine in a box. Thereafter, I'm going to travel through a few publications by artists associated with visual poetry, Fluxus, pop art, minimal art, post-minimal art, conceptual art, and then somehow make my way into the 90s, the 1990s, where I will overview a larger collection of editions produced by artists emerging in the 90s. I guess that assumes that we have enough time to do that. Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah. The first publication that first box publication that I'm going to overview is the Magazine in a Box Aspen. The first issue was done in 1965, and basically it continued for 10 issues, ending in 1971. The early issues were, I would say, not so in sync with the contemporary art world in terms of the fact that there was not much of an art component included in issue number one and number two, although there was certainly a emphasis on design and possibly interests of artists from that moment, emerging artists of that moment, but there wasn't much of a specific art component. It begins really with issue the pop art issue, which I guess is number what, 3 or 4 or 5, Stephen Lieber. I haven't, but I can't I can't talk now because I'm recording something. So, okay, let me call you back. Bye.
So this first issue looks to me like it's really based in the place, like Aspen, Colorado, because there's a small staple-bound publication about skiing, about jazz, sanctuary for deer, birds, peacocks, and people. Hide and seek of the Timberline, and then a section for ads and
absolutely. This is a magazine that was contained in a box, and the sort of advertising material concerning this magazine sets that out very clearly, that it's the magazine in a box. But that you picked up on this early issue being really overtly about a place, Aspen, that is, also syncs to what Phyllis Johnson, the editor, notes in this initial offering. The articles will be surprising as the format, ranging from beautiful picture stories on nature and sports to the more esoteric subjects of art, humanistic studies, design, underground movies, music, always with a record, poetry, dance, architecture, gourmet dining. In other words, all the civilized pleasures of modern living based on the Greek idea of the whole man, as exemplified by what goes on in Aspen, Colorado, one of the few places in America where you can lead a well-rounded, eclectic life of visual, physical, and mental splendor. Anyway, that pretty much sums the early concept of this magazine.
But there's also in that manifesto a letter of intention with this first issue, is that contained in a box, you have some leeway with what you can put inside, because it doesn't all have to be bound together. It can be these loose parts. And
exactly. What she says in this issue, and again, I'm sorry, I'm reading from this letter, although it may not be that easy to find this letter. She states, for the first issue, we've started out with a rather dignified format, but who knows what the next issue will be. Perhaps the booklets will be done in the manner of illuminated manuscripts or Japanese scrolls. Perhaps each will be a different size and colors. Perhaps they'll include blueprints, a bit of rock, wildflower seeds, tea samples, an opera libretti, old newspapers, jigsaw puzzles. In short, and this is the, in short, Aspen is the first three-dimensional magazine. Anyway.
So they're really predicting what they're going to be talking about in the next issues.
Well, they're letting you know that anything could happen.
Yeah.
In any case, this first issue has this quite elaborate advertising section, which they identify as an ad gallery and is contained in its own folder, and then basically the subjects that you've already read here: skiing, jazz, nature, essentially, and the 15th annual International Design Conference in Aspen. As said previously, this first issue, although clearly with great attention to what it looks like, does not contain much of anything concerning art. There were no artist contributions in that first issue. The second issue also was light to non-existent in regards to an art contribution. This issue is made up of a number of, I guess it's five, small booklets. The booklets, however, are extremely idiosyncratic, extremely interesting mm-hmm. in format, in that this booklet, which measures what this booklet cover mentions something like what is this 4 inches?
Yeah, 4 or 5 inches wide and 6 inches.
6 inches up top, up and down, 4 3/4 inches across.
It folds out into a poster.
And mounted into the cover is essentially a poster format publication, the Adaptable House. Instead of limiting the living, it grows and changes with its inhabitants. Actually, I looked at this a number of times, but didn't remember that this had this format.
Are the others this way too?
Let's look. But actually, it just is interesting to pull this out now when I realize, because I've just realized that this format is the format that you see a few years later. In Bruce Nauman's Burning Small Fires. Mm-hmm. You know, it's oversized, but it's basically a related format. No, they're all completely different. This issue, Farewell to a Canyon, is basically a folder, and you've got sheets, leaves, essentially, 14 leaves.
So they were really experimenting with design and format, and they must have had a pretty good budget for all of these.
Clearly. I guess what they also mention in that manifesto of sorts is that the content of the contributions dictate the design formats. In other words, they're not fitting round pegs and square holes here. The design function follows the content, or what the artist is putting out, the nature of the if it's not by an artist, it's how the I'm imagining how the designer imagined the content of the piece to best be communicated. I think with the example of that architectural model, that was a good example, in that the format was kind of like there was a lot of structure to the form. Anyway, issue number 3 is the pop art issue, the issue that was coordinated by Warhol. The issue was designed by Warhol and David Dalton. It's got the on the cover, the Fab. It's the Fab issue. That's been Fab.
Nice.
Yeah. And
then back.
Yeah. Also
this is
nice. Borax.
Borax.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
This is the single most collectible
now,
issue.
Being a little bit of an insider on Aspen Magazine, it was published in two different places, right? The Roaring Fork Press, the publisher of Aspen Magazine, was located in New York at a certain time and also in Colorado. Is that correct? Or do you know the story?
Good question. Not sure. Clearly, it shows that this publication is published bimonthly in New York. I'm imagining maybe this Phyllis, whatever her name is now, name escapes me, was Phyllis Johnson, was possibly had residence also in Colorado, or the funding that the investors for this magazine were in Colorado, or you know, and also possibly, especially when you heard what that manifesto noted, is that Aspen is certainly an inspirational place for the publication.
Okay.
In any case,
I was just curious if maybe this third issue, the turning point, was somehow related to being published in New York instead of in Colorado.
Well, it's possible. Let's just look here. No. See, the second issue was also the imprint is Waverly Place, New York, and ditto for number one.
Huh.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so but certainly the content of this issue is much more about
really
New York than New York and.
But
and
that could be because of Warhol and the designer.
Yeah.
As well, so do you think they gave the artist that they chose to be in the issue some sort of some editorial control or graphic design control?
It's 11:15.
Certainly. I think it's not clear to me in looking at this issue who actually was editorially in charge. It's clear who designed it, that is Warhol and I'm assuming Dalton. But as to what was actually included here, it's a little less clear. Unlike some of the other issues, for example, number 8, you know, it's absolutely clear that Dan Graham edited it. Number 5, 6 with Doherty, it's absolutely clear who edited it. But this, in this case, it's not clear who was the editor. The designer was the designers are the people that pop out as being the featured people behind the issue. In any case, this issue, the pop issue, that's how it's mostly known, includes a number of contents. Again, the form of the publication is mixed. That is, there's all different types of things included in this publication. In that this issue has FlexiDisc. It has a double-sided flipbook. It's got a tabloid publication. Like all the issues, or most all the issues, it includes a ad section. There's also, in this case, some sort of oversized, well, it's a booklet, you might say, on pop and op paintings from the Powers collection. John Powers being a British collector, I guess, who lived in Aspen at that time, and this is selections from his collection. It was much larger than 12 paintings. In addition,
you said that John Powers may have been one of the funders of this magazine earlier, but that's not something you know.
I don't know that for a fact. That's a guess. Like, there are signs that maybe that is descriptive. One thing that I mentioned about Aspen in our first try at recording this day is the fact that the magazine. All parts of the magazine, including the ad section, the elements are all numbered. So I'm under the impression that the editors, designers, thought of the box as the kind of binding, and the contents needed some sort of, I guess, felt like there should be some collation, and so all the items, whether or not it's a flyer or something more publication like, you know, a booklet or a record, all of these parts are numbered, and that's including even the box itself. In the case of this December issue, volume 1, number 3, the box designed by Warhol and Dalton, that item is numbered. Okay.
See the item numbering on that specifically.
Okay.
But a lot of them.
The number in this issue for this item is, just trying to find something wrong with what I'm saying.
No.
Oh,
I'm
God.
Just, I was going to take a photograph of the number because that was a brightly colored thing.
Here it is. It's on the side.
Okay.
Section 8, volume 1, number 3.
Okay.
Just trying to prove me wrong again.
Well, I mean, this was a good way for the publishers and editors to have some control over how this thing was viewed, because then you know it's complete if you see all the numbers are here and you have a way of collating it and a way of experiencing the box, because it's a box, it's not bound, and part of publications is sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like it was important to them to still have it be read like a typical book or magazine somehow.
Even though,
and they found a way to do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going back to this volume 2. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I wonder what the how these issues actually came to the subscriber at the time, in that I wonder if they came in a collated form, or if the form of the packing form, or the distribution form may have been based on just concerns of packing in general, because as I wasn't a subscriber and purchased this set in a used book context, the contents were not in a particular order. I had to collate myself to determine whether or not this was a complete set. I guess also I think that it's important to have the parts identified, so you know what is, so you know that it's all there. There is something about this, the sort of all over reading, that you can pick and choose, and I guess I like the freedom of reading or engaging with these publications, in that and then this more or less open structure works that way. In addition to the more art related contents, there are the music. There is music covered here, both in a textual way and in the Flexi, which has a Velvet Underground John Cale written song loop. Let's move on.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with this publication how they wanted to create a kind of a full experience for you, a full cultural experience. You got music and poetry and art, photography, ads, design,
mm-hmm. even games. Because this pop art issue, if you want to call it that, also has this sort of, you know, this drug angle as well. The 10 trip ticket book, which is not really identified by author. Oh, take it back.
Do you think that has LSD on it?
I don't know. I didn't.
You didn't lick it.
Interesting thought, Amber. Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's a 10 trip ticket booklet, then
yeah.
That discoloring on the back is what that is.
Yeah, probably not. But anyway. This has this has this issue covers, I think, the beat at the moment to a certain extent of, somebody living in New York in 1966, in that you've got the avant-garde film connection with Jack Smith and Warhol. You've got the pop art and the op art going on here in reproduction, as well as via the design components of this periodical. But then, in addition, you've got this Berkeley Conference on LSD covered in some kind of exhaustive way with, I guess, 12 contributions concerning LSD. Anyway, let's move on. This would be considered, I guess, in the market, not that this is about the market, but this would be considered the most desirable of the issues. The next issue that they ran was the McLuhan issue, and that's how it's identified. This Marshall McLuhan issue of Aspen was co-designed by Quentin Fiore, the co-author with McLuhan of The Medium is the Massage. I always say message, but you know that's what he's saying, right? And I guess like all the other boxes pretty much following issue three, the pop box, I think these boxes really read also quite well as small exhibitions concerning a subject concerning a subject or a moment in time or a place. You could imagine going into a smaller size space and hearing a record, the Flexi of Kale or this Flexi in this issue by Gordon Mumma of the Once Group Theater Ensemble, and with these broadsides designed by Quentin Fiore, or in the case of the Warhol issue, just by showing the cover as a kind of work by him, box, Brillo box, Campbell soup box, whatever, and then the contents beyond. I mean, these boxes do really come off as being exhibitions of sorts on either a single person, like in this case.
So it's sort of like an exhibition. It could be an exhibition in your living room. So you have it has a poster that you could put out. It has some publications you could have on your coffee table. It has a record, a flexi disc that you could listen to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an exhibition, but it's also much, much more. It wouldn't be a typical exhibition space to have a record playing and some publications and some posters in a box.
Well, I guess it depends on
the exhibition.
I mean, it certainly depends. If you go to Bremen, to the city museum there, the Westerburg Museum, and you see the exhibitions that are put on through this archive they have of from Guy Schrenen, this small press archive, which includes a collection of multiples, a collection of artist books, a collection of mail art, a collection of visual poetry, a collection of sound art, that in the context of that venue, an exhibition of this sort of material would be normal. So I mean, it is different. I'm just pointing out that this has the capacity to be seen that way.
Sure.
I mean, simply stated, this magazine is presents a different way, a fresh way of engaging in material, printed material, in that the active engagement with the stuff that you're reading in this form is quite a lot different from turning the pages of a magazine or turning the pages of a book. This requires like getting up, turning it upside down. I mean, there's a lot of there's real physical engagement with this this format that
mm-hmm.
they came up with. So, I mean, in the case of Aspen, especially in regards to, well, basically all the issues starting with issue number 3, the pop box, you see how the storage function of the box, it goes way, you know, goes way beyond preserving, in that preserving the material, or, I mean, if you want to, obliterating it. But, I mean, it goes beyond that in that the containers themselves are a space for presentation of art, or at minimum design, in that, you know, for example, in the Warhol box, you've got, you know, a Warhol work of sorts. At least, I mean, you one could look at it that way.
Yeah, designed by him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's preserving and presenting.
Exactly.
In this case.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. These boxes are also the first group of them up to, I guess, well, through that issue just covered, which is issue 4. The boxes are fairly sturdy. They're certainly breakable. They
uh-huh.
split at the corners, but they certainly are crushable, and that's one of the bound to fail aspects of the Aspen magazine set.
Or boxes in general.
Yeah, I guess you could say that boxes are general, although we're going to, you know, look at today, the 7 Objects in a Box, by Tanglewood Press, published by Tanglewood Press, the box that contained primarily the artists associated with post-minimalism, and that box, that wooden box, isn't too easy to destroy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so...
But yeah, like that it's still a printed and paper material, so that it has still sort of a temporary life in this case, a little bit more.
Certainly, I'm trying to preserve it here.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next issue that was published was issue number 5-6. One of the more spectacular issues as well is this is the issue that's referred to by some anyway as the minimal art issue. Comes in a white box and it's in 28 sections. Basically,
so back to that numbering system. This one is section 3, Aspen Magazine number 5+6. So each of 28 sections is numbered that way. Whoops.
Exactly.
Section 28,
right.
Aspen Magazine 5-6.
The ad section.
Yeah.
Anyway, this issue is a bit theoretical in that there is a translated text by Barthes. There's a Kubler piece. There's also a piece, an essay by Susan Sontag. There's fiction as well in this issue. Burroughs, Alain Robbe-Grier, and then the music is new music by Cage, realized by Max Neuhaus, and another work by Morton Feldman, again with a contribution by Max Neuhaus. There's a sculpture, a multiple if you will, by Tony Smith, the minimal artist, and then there is a film reel. Yeah, this is the only issue of Aspen that contained the film. Here you go. And this film reel contained short works by Hans Richter, Moholy Nagy, Robert Morris, and Stan Vanderbeek, as well as Robert Rauschenberg. So it's, starts from the 20s and
wow.
Basically ends up around 1967 in terms
so
of the contributions.
They were surveying minimalism from the 20s through the
60s?
No,
I wouldn't say that. I would just say that I always think of this box as the minimal box because of the Smith contribution, and then also contributions by... LeWitt, Bochner and Neuhaus and Feldman being more minimal music makers, or that's one way one might characterize their production. But no, you know, you can't really think of Rauschenberg as a minimal artist. But in any case, that's I try to my way of referring to these boxes in a kind of trade fashion or in a crib notes fashion. I always refer to this in this way, and I think most people do as well. In any case, there are other documents that are included in this issue. Several things.
Sorry to interrupt you, but these aren't titled. They aren't necessarily titled. They kind of assume titles after you describe what the contents are. Like the Fab Box number 3, you call it Fab because it has Fab on the cover.
Right. Well, I refer to that as the Pop Box.
The Pop Box.
Right. Because that seems, well.
And this is the minimal box.
Because of Tony Smith, basically.
And
I guess
the first issue of Aspen Magazine.
Well, I refer to the first issue typically as the one, either as the first issue or the issue on skiing. And I consider, I mean, some of the other boxes, it's more clear as to what they are because they're titled, okay?
Are some that are titled. They're not all just Aspen 5-6,
yeah,
Aspen 3.
Exactly. For example, the Aspen number 8 is titled as Art Information Science. However, I always refer to that basically as a conceptual art box. And obviously the fourth issue, the issue that we just covered, is the McLuhan issue. So I mean, it's identified as such. And then
okay.
The British box is the British box, and the psychedelic box is the psychedelic box,
okay.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So it's just a short way of referring to these. And so, no, it's not exactly covering only minimal artists. In fact, some people might even consider Tony Smith to not be an artist associated with minimalism, but sort of predates minimalism. But in any case,
Go on.
Yeah,
I apologize.
This one I think is particularly full with extremely interesting contributions, as there is like 1, 2, 3, 4. There's like 5 flexi discs, the films, and then some very interesting writing and sort of book works by various of the contributors. Serial Project number 1 by Saul LeWitt is considered to be by him as his first artist book. That's how it reads in the catalog resume of his artist books.
Mm-hmm. And Saul LeWitt published, or has after this made a pretty large series of artist books.
Yeah, there's a good, I guess, there's probably around 30 artist books produced by him, yeah. Thank you. He was prolific in that way, and was, as you know, one of the founders of Printed Matter. So, the sort of.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the one of the founding members of Printed Matter, the space that's existed since the 70s that more or less was championed artist publications. And was one of the few that has done so since that time. Art, Printed Matter and Art Metropole are the essentially mainstays in that field.
They have an archive that would be similar to yours?
Printed Matter?
Mm-hmm.
Printed Matter doesn't have a archive they don't have a collection. They might have, they have a archive that covers their goings on there,
mm-hmm.
But in terms of having a collection of, let's just say, all the material that they handled at that time throughout the years, no,
mm-hmm.
I'm under the impression they don't have such a collection. However, Art Metropole had a collection of that sort of material, which was put together by...
Art Metropole is located where?
Toronto.
Uh-huh.
Art Metropole basically had an archive that was started... by General Idea, the members of General Idea, and became because of Art Metropole's publication, It wasn't Art Metropole. Because of General Ideas publication File Magazine, which to a certain extent was run out of or around Art Metropole during some point in its history, material was sent to General Idea or to File Magazine, and for that matter, probably simply to Art Metropole as in exchange or just because that's how material was distributed at that time. And our Art Metropole, or rather General Idea, I combine them because they're so connected, they did link very closely to the mail art correspondence art situation internationally at that moment in time. And so artists that were working in that way also produced artist publications, artist books, etc. A lot of that material, or much of that material, ended up in what became known as the Art Metropole Collection, or archive rather, which is presently housed at the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Anyway, back on point. Issue number 8, Aspen, the fall-winter issue concerning art information and science, was edited by the conceptual artist Dan Graham. And the issue was designed by George Michunas, the founder of Fluxus, and certainly the basic packaging, the box, if you will, certainly
a little bit more of a folder than a box.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The container in this case was very clearly coded Michunas based on the font that's incorporated in this issue. The font for the let's just say the general information that can be found here. The contributions, on the other hand, really take the form of mixed material, and they don't exhibit design features, much of the design features of Michunas. I see here in looking at the Art and Vision, the Joe Bear publication, this is completely designed by Michunas. You can tell by the text. Okay,
and
but
as well.
And that as well, the Anton as well. On the other end, you look at this, the Ruscha contribution, and I don't know. It's a little bit harder to see it here. Maybe so.
Yeah, and we have our order form. So at the time, if you were subscribing to Aspen Magazine, it cost you $16 a year, $32 for 2 years.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, taking a closer look. There are certain contributions where it's clear that there wasn't room for the designer, and then in other cases, it's clear that the design is all Michunas. I mean, especially when you look at this David Anton text work, in place of a lecture, Three Musics for Two Voices by David Anton, it's clearly all designed by Michunas. Ditto.
It must have taken quite a bit of time for this to happen, because say you got raw text from a writer, and then it had to be designed by the artist and all put together and printed. It seems like, you know, it's a...
Yeah, it's not clear to me how many issues were produced each year. However, I guess I have a list here. In 1965, there was only one issue. In 66, there were two issues. 67, two issues.
Mm-hmm.
68, 69, only one issue. 70, no, actually, yeah, 70, two issues, presumably. The last issue was published in 1971, and that was only a single issue year. So, I mean, a whole year to produce these issues by and large. Anyway, to get back on this point of the contribution by Machinus in this box, you can see when there wasn't space for such design elements, it doesn't appear. I mean, the Reich contribution shows none of it,
mm-hmm.
none of him. Ditto for Richard Serra in this lead shot. On the other end, you look at the Lamont Young work, and it's clearly designed by Machinus. Same thing, glass. Not so with Reiner, but completely the case with the Smithson, in fact, which
oh,
is
wow.
curious. Yeah.
That's pretty.
Strata, Geophotographic Fiction by Robert Smithson. Oh, I just ripped it. Or ripped part of it. Can't say I haven't used this. Anyway, this is one of my favorite issues.
Do you know how many of these were published?
I don't know what the edition size is, but the edition is clearly not small. This has, you know, all the features of a publication that would have been produced in a large quantity. I don't think you make flexi discs in small quantity, basically.
Oh, okay.
Makes
sense.
Yeah. Grind. Issue 9. Well, excuse me. Issue 8 before 9. The British issue 7, excuse me.
7, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, so we just did 8.
Did we do 8? Yeah, we skipped ahead.
It's 11:45.
Anyway, issue 7, the British box, Aspen number 7, British box, spring, summer, whatever the date is. In any case, this covers the British scene, a combination of, again, music, art, fiction, poetry. In this case, the contributors of the essay and poetry, the writing, was Ballard, Chris Finch, Edward Lucy Smith, covering British poetry now, which was basically the British visual poets. And then the record works were by Yoko Ono and John Lennon, with a more poetical, political record work by Christopher Logue and John Tavener. The objects, or let's say the things that are more work-like, artwork-like, combination of the visual poets Finlay and Furnival, and then you've got contributions by Peter Blake, the British pop artist, as well as Hockney, the British pop artist, and Palozzi, the sort of pre-pop British artists. I guess you could consider them even pop as well. The cover itself, the box itself, was designed by Richard Smith, a sculptor, painter, and that represents his single artwork or his single contribution to this issue.
Mm-hmm.
This issue is the most easily destroyed because of its depth. So again, after number 4, the formats, after the British box, the formats really do change substantially. The number 8 box that I presented last takes the form of a kind of folder. This is a square-er box, and this dream weapon, the psychedelic issue number 9, is really almost like a peachy folder,
yeah,
almost.
Cardstock
folder with a very extravagantly produced cover, very psychedelic. This issue contains contributions again by Lamont Young and his partner Marianne Zazella, There are records in this case, as well as poetry sheets, broadsides. This has also a booklet of, well, it's really a book by Benno Friedman, the photographer. I would say this issue, as well as contributions by Malonga and Ira Cohn. I would say this issue
has a postcard set and a stamp set too.
Exactly. The connection with contemporary art is a little bit disparate in this case. This is more, it seems like, of a lifestyle somehow issue.
But still very, very designed.
Completely. This photo book by Benno Friedman is, you know, this is one of the few, this pretty much is the only book that I can think of that takes this form in this set of periodicals. Again, I think one realizes when looking at this that the contributions dictate the form the works take.
Uh-huh.
Perforated stamp sheet, Lumographs by Don Snyder. Pretty psychedelic. This contribution, this issue was printed in Japan, apparently. Mm-hmm. Text on Dream Music by Lamont Young. Terry Riley's score. Anyway. I think we'll skip to the end here. The final issue. And it seems like the either there were budgetary concerns or the editorial direction had gone a little bit, was a little bit less inspired in that the last issue, the format is quite a bit less deluxe, not uninteresting, but it's a box that gives very interesting design, or rather construction directions. It has a kind of origami like.
Yeah, it has instructions about how to put
fold,
make
fold
the box thing into three dimensional. It comes as flat.
Exactly. And this issue basically covers Chinese art, Japanese art, Tibetan art. The contributions are mostly leaves. However, I guess there are a couple of booklets. One booklet on Indian miniature paintings. And I guess a text. It seems like a kind of travel log by Gary Snyder, first time round. Posters. Anyway, yeah.
The contents is still.
Yeah, the same thing. Items are identified by section number, table of contents. It's design consultant is noted as usual. And, in a box. So, Aspen Magazine, better images than what we've just taken, or easier to access, can be found online at this website, ubu.com, if I'm not incorrect.
Yeah, ubu.com/Aspen.
And
full descriptions and photographs of all of the contents.
Right. And, Let's move on.
It's 11:52.
Okay. Next publication that's contained in a box that I'd like to talk about is a work by the UK visual poet Ian Hamilton Finlay, entitled Earthship. It's from 1966. The box itself is also, the box contains the piece, Earthship. The box itself is designed by Alistair Kent, which often collaborated with Finlay. One thing about Finlay Publications in general is he had collaborators. I mean, you don't find very many works by Finlay that are strictly produced by Finlay. I mean, a sculpture by Finlay could have a text by another visual poet.
Uh-huh.
You could have a text by Finlay, but designed by or sort of laid out or presented by Furnival, etc., etc. So there are collaboration is a crucial ingredient with Finlay. Ian Hamilton Finlay had a press called the Wild Hawthorne Press, which published this box, but many, many other artist books, cards, broadsides, poster poems, multiples, etc., hundreds, if not, you know, into the thousands. And starting from the 60s, I think mid-60s, and only recently closing down due to his passing. Earthship is a poem, a poetry object, a work that's
really a sculpture, paper sculpture.
Exactly. It's Bristol board that has been attached by staples, two staples per section. The poem reads, Fin funnel I hold bow stern, star number, root branch, sail sap screw. It's a silkscreen on Bristol board. Attached, as I said, dimensions variable, presentation variable.
Yeah, I love it like that with the words visible but standing up.
Exactly.
You can put it any way.
It has toy-like qualities, and Finlay was also known for building toys as well. And you could say that there are a certain number of sculptures that have by him from the early days that are very clearly toy-inspired or toy-like, playing off toys in general. I think Mary Ellen Solt, in her book From Concrete Poetry, World View, parses this poem fairly well, in that the first line, Fin funnel I hold bow stern, that's how she breaks it down into the sort of first line, is basically a description of a ship, plus an I, E-Y-E. The next two words, star number, I guess stars have numbers, but so do boats. Boats typically are identified by, at least there is a number often in them.
It's also, the title is Earthship,
mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a thinking of the Earth as a ship.
Mm-hmm. A star sailing in space, okay?
mm-hmm.
The next two words are root branch, and sort of suggesting that this boat has no anchor, but instead a root from a branch. And then finally, sail, sap, screw. It has a sail, the boat has a sail, the boat has a screw, but its fuel is life-giving sap. Mm-hmm. And that's how Salt breaks this down.
And last time we opened this, the first association I got was that it looks a lot like Evruchet's every building on the Sunset Strip, because it has this sort of almost accordion like display way that you could put it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that book in exhibitions all folded out,
right.
And this has a
it certainly can be presented something along those lines.
It's more variable.
It's more variable. I see it as being more sculptural than the way one reads Every Building on the Sunset Strip. This predates Every Building on the Sunset Strip, by a year or so, but I would imagine that this was not likely the inspiration for the Rucher format.
Right. It's just a coincidence for us. All right. Thank you.
This copy of the box was sent to Gail Turnbull, one of his collaborators as well, another visual poet.
Yeah, this box is really sturdy. It's a very, very thick, hard board. Good for mailing the piece just as it was, which is a nice, it's all contained.
Yeah.
It doesn't have this extra outside packing material.
Yeah, it's a little bit surprising that this was sent in the mail as is, as it's so part of the piece to me, but it was a gift, and you know, I guess it wasn't traveling too far, but it is curious that this actually traveled in this way.
It looks like it was designed to be mailed.
Certainly.
It has a place for an address, a return address,
mm-hmm.
and it has a postcard format image on the front.
Yeah, well, where the label might be is where the, was left open, so it's clearly that was part of the design of it. It just sort of surprises me because it is such a precious thing once you open up the box.
We've got about a minute left.
Okay.
Before we start recording, I think
maybe it makes sense to stop here and move into a few Fluxus editions before we...
It's 12 o'clock.
Let's stop here.